Hi, I'm Dr. Sejal Hathi. Welcome to Civic RX, where we talk with key leaders, thinkers, activists, and changemakers who are reimagining our global health system. This first season, we're exploring the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Who is it affecting most? What other crises, social, political, moral, has it exploited and revealed? And how can we harness this moment to rebuild a more just and wholesome health system? 1 year ago this month, America lost its first life to the coronavirus. Since then, nearly 500,000 Americans have succumbed to the pandemic, many more losing their family, their classrooms, and their livelihoods. No person has been more widely reviled for dooming a response than former President Donald Trump. But a new report published in British medical journal The Lancet finds that as damaging as were Trump's actions and his antagonism towards science, they represented merely the extension of a long tradition of harmful policies stretching back decades, which collectively left the United States acutely vulnerable to the pandemic. Indeed, life expectancy even prior to 2020 in the United States was lagging behind its peers. Had it simply kept pace, the report laments, with other G7 nations, in 2018 alone, the deaths of 461,000 Americans could have been averted. This report, published by the Lancet Commission on Public Policy and Health in the Trump era, offers an unsparing assessment of the many and overlapping failures of the U.S. healthcare system, as well as of the social malaise and policy choices that fueled and have perpetuated those failures over four decades. Here to discuss their findings and what they mean for a nation struggling to move forward is Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, co-chair of the Lancet Commission and distinguished professor in the CUNY School of Public Health at Hunter College. Dr. Woolhandler is a practicing primary care physician, as well as a co-founder and board member of Physicians for a National Health Program, the only national physician organization dedicated to implementing a single-payer health program in the United States, now encompassing more than 20,000 members. She has authored over 150 journal articles, chapters, and books on health policy, and continues to inform the national debate as a staunch champion of Medicare for All. I could not be more thrilled to welcome Dr. Woolhandler to the podcast and hope you learn as much as I did from our conversation. As a reminder, if you enjoy what you hear, please rate us on iTunes, learn more, and subscribe to the show at civic-rx.org, and feel free to reach out with your feedback, your suggestions, and your ideas for guests. Without further ado, here's Dr. Woolhandler. Thank you, Steffi, so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
You and more than 30 of your colleagues just released a damning and insightful new report in The Lancet outlining the various implications and impacts of the Trump administration on health. What was the genesis story of that report and this commission? What triggered its creation? Was it the mere election of Trump or something perhaps more sinister, be it a policy or an event that thereafter transpired?
I had been leading an effort to run a series in The Lancet about health inequality in the United States, which had come out very near to the time of Trump's election. I was going to see Richard Horton, who's the editor of The Lancet, about that series. At the time, it was about April of 2017, so Trump had been inaugurated several months before, and he had set in motion a series of policies that were clearly going to harm human health. And at that point, we were just projecting that they would harm human health. So we were seeing policies like the Muslim ban, a clearly racist immigration policy. We were seeing things like appointing Scott Pruitt to head the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Scott Pruitt had made his entire career suing the EPA to try to stop environmental regulation that gives us clean air and clean water. He had been appointed the head of the EPA. And it was clear that Trump was going to do a lot of health harming things. So we predicted that he would, in fact, worsen the health of the American people. But of course, we had no idea just how bad it would be. And by the time that the report went to press, almost 4 years later, we had real numbers to show how harmful his policies had been. So for instance, we saw that environmental and occupational deaths, which we predicted would probably go up because of his policies, had risen by 22,000 per year between the day of his inauguration and 2019. We saw that his rejection of science and contempt for public health and for, frankly, compassion had led to a much worse COVID pandemic than it needed to be. Trump did not cause the COVID pandemic, but if the United States had just been able to achieve the level of control of the pandemic of the average of the other nations in the G7, we would have had fewer deaths. So a lot of things he had just put in place or started putting in place early in his administration bore some very bitter fruit and a lot of dead Americans in terms of his failure to protect health.
No, absolutely. And I want to talk about his impact specifically on the COVID-19 pandemic and the devastating effects it's wreaked on our country and the world. But let's go back to what you shared about the deaths lost, the missing Americans prior even to the COVID-19 pandemic. One of the principal arguments of the report is that our current predicament, as you just alluded to, is not the handiwork of Trump alone, but rather the product of bipartisan neoliberalism dating back 40 years, beginning with President Carter to Nixon to Reagan. Trump was the most egregious, most extreme iteration of these policies, but not their precipitant. What happened in the late 1970s to trigger this shift from Keynesian economic orthodoxy and the brand of New Deal liberalism that had dominated the policy landscape for the past half century?
I think progress toward equality in the United States really began with Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal. And he was very good on economic equality, but was not very focused on racial equality, let's say. And then in the Johnson era, in the we call it Great Society era, Johnson was able to expand the New Deal and make it much more inclusive in terms of including minorities and women. There really was a steady improvement in equality and the standard of living, and especially in the life expectancy of Americans. About 1980, we did see the beginning of these new politics, and the term neoliberal might not be that familiar to most of your listeners, but it's very misleading because neoliberal is not new and it's not liberal. It's actually a new form of conservatism that was reborn around 1980, and it was embraced by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. And the whole idea was they attacked government. They said, oh, we hate big government. But that's not exactly true. They just remade government to make it smaller in terms of the social services offered to the population, but much bigger in terms of protecting corporations and rich people. They said, oh, we're for deregulating, but that's not exactly true either, because what they did was they got rid of regulations that protected lower and middle income people and re-regulated the nation and the world economy to protect corporate profit making. And that's really what neoliberalism is. We talk about globalization. But of course, there's a lot of good aspects of globalization. It's good for people to trade with each other and travel and have business that practices across borders. But there was a particular form of globalization that was neoliberal, which was corporations were going to be allowed to do what they wanted to cross borders to move their money, whereas working people would be much more restricted and see their rights shrunken down. So that's really what neoliberalism is. As I say, it's a very confusing term, and people often talk about the way Ronald Reagan turned around the Republican Party. But of course, he turned around the Republican Party and the whole politics in this country, so that when Clinton came into power in the 1990s, he was also saying the age of big government is over. It sounds like a neoliberal statement that you're going to shrink government. He was also supporting much more punitive policies in terms of criminal justice and criminalization of drug use. And he was also supporting things that were very, very harmful to poor people, like time limits on cash welfare benefits, and telling immigrants, even immigrants who had come into this country legally, that they would not be eligible for any sort of food stamps or health care for the first 5 years they were in the country, a law that's still on the books today. It was started by Reagan and in general has been pushed much more rapidly in Republican administrations than in Democratic administrations. But it's kind of become a new economic orthodoxy that, oh, we're going to shrink public services and use public money in ways that actually benefit corporate power.
Yeah. It seems, hopefully, that that consensus is again starting to shift, and that the events of the last year, from the COVID-19 pandemic to the racial protests and the economic fallout that has ensued from all of these events, it seems that the year 2020 was just so pivotal that people are finally starting to see the follies and the flaws of this orthodoxy. So I hope that the next administration makes policy that aligned with that emerging understanding. And I know that there are 13 plus recommendations and many others therein in the commission's report for the incoming administration. But what would you say are the most critical actions over the course of the remainder of these first 100 days that the Biden administration should take to begin to correct some of this damage?
One of the most important things, which Biden has done, is to have a policy about COVID that's based on science and compassion. So he has again put scientists in charge of making the decisions and is increasing the prestige and the funding for the CDC, which Trump was attacking throughout his presidency. So in the short run, that's pretty important, that piece. I think a lot of stuff that's being talked about now is really breaking with the neoliberal orthodoxy, the idea that we need to give working people money during a pandemic, just cash, you know, that's going to help a whole lot. The idea that we need a $15 an hour minimum wage, the idea that we as a society need to help support raising children through child credits. We are seeing some changes in the way we think about things, but we need much more. I mean, we need to repeal the Trump tax bill, which took $1.9 trillion, cut it from the federal treasury, and gave 83% of the benefit to rich people. We need to be actually taxing rich people and using that money to support social programs like universal health care, like free education, like nutrition programs, decent education and housing for everyone. The place to get that money is from the very rich, who have gotten richer and richer and richer, certainly since 1980, but particularly during the Trump years.
How do you reconcile this exigent need for structural reform with the fundamental moderation of U.S. voters, certainly prior to the events of this last year, who disproportionately distrust the government to do what's right on public health and on poverty, and whose faith has been even more tested during 2020?
Politicians have been the ones going out and saying we need small government, don't trust government, government doesn't work. I think we need a different kind of politics that says you don't have to trust the politicians, but you should believe that the government can raise money through taxes and can improve the economy and the quality of life for everyone. A lot of countries have done this, countries that are not particularly left-wing. Certainly the rest of the G7 nations, and that would be Japan, Germany, Italy, France, UK, Canada, they're not left-wing countries. And yet they've put in place social supports and conditions that allow them to live on average 3.4 years longer than Americans. And back in 1980, as we said in the report, back in 1980, life expectancy in the U.S. was identical to the G7 average. And here we are lagging 3.4 years behind in the year before COVID, So this is a generational failure of US policymakers to put in place the conditions that allow my patients and your patients to be healthy. There's a lot we can do for patients when they get sick, but if they don't have nutrition, if they don't have education, if they don't have a healthy living environment, they're being exposed to tobacco and dangerous cars and dangerous workplaces. It's very limited what we can do. We need the policymakers to create the conditions for health in order to do our job.
Yeah, I respect that. And I agree with you. I hope that the Democrats under this new administration message that need more effectively than they did during particularly the Obama years. I feel that as powerful a piece of legislation as the ACA was, it was inadequate, but it's changed the conversation. It nevertheless came at tremendous political cost. And I think that's because they did not message it as effectively as they might have. Are there lessons from the Obama era that you think the new administration should heed as it's pushing forward a more progressive platform?
I think, in fact, Medicare for All would have been a better reform than Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. The difference is that really when the Affordable Care Act came into effect, many middle-class people didn't see any improvement in their situation. So they might have insurance, but they couldn't afford their co-payments and deductibles. They were threatened with bankruptcy if they got sick despite having insurance. And really, the Obamacare legislation didn't fix that. Now, the really good thing it did was provide Medicaid or subsidized insurance, and it did cut the number of uninsured people approximately in half. And that's a big success. In half means going from 50 million to 25 million. So at the beginning of the Trump presidency, there were still 25 million people who were uninsured. So I think Obamacare would have been a whole lot more popular if it had covered everyone and fixed the problems of people who have insurance they can't afford to use. So I know part of it's messaging, and without really the bill changing very much, it did become more popular over time. So maybe there was a messaging issue. But the fundamental problem is a lot of the American people were left with problems paying for care that Obamacare didn't actually fix for them.
Obviously, Medicare for All has occupied the debate in a way that it never had previously. My question to you is, having championed this proposal since the turn of the century, why is it that Americans are so loath to embrace what is more beneficial to them? Why are they so resistant to doing away with private insurance, which is increasingly complicated, expensive, and inadequate? Where is this coming from?
Well, I think there was a Morning Consult poll a couple of years ago that really got at this question. So if you ask people, do you support Medicare for All? Something like 56% of the electorate says they support Medicare for All. If they say, would you support Medicare for All if it gave you choice of any doctor or any hospital, the support goes up. If you say, would you support Medicare for All if it gave you choice of any doctor or hospital but was a single payer, did not allow private insurance, the support continues to be high. So I think there's a lot of confusion. People think when you say take away private insurance, what you're talking about is taking away their doctor or their hospital. And you know, I really believe patients want and ought to have a choice about their doctor or hospital. But what they don't understand from the messaging is that Medicare for All gives you that. Essentially, every doctor in the United States takes Medicare. Essentially, every hospital in the United States takes Medicare. They won't take your private insurance, particularly if you're in a managed care plan. They may or may not be willing to take it, or the doctor may not be in the network. So Medicare is actually a program that maximizes choice of doctor or hospital. And I think that's what needs to be explained, because people do want to maintain their choice of doctor and hospital. And the insurance industry has managed to confuse the debate and say, this is about choice and this is about rationing. And really, Medicare for All does not involve rationing and it maximizes choice.
Do you have hope that something approaching Medicare for All will be feasible in the next 4 years?
Medicare for All will require that it be legislated. And I don't think you can get it all through reconciliation. So you probably need 60 votes. There's pieces of it you can do through reconciliation, probably, which means you just need a simple majority. But the parts of it that would require you to have 60 votes, that may have to wait. However, there's another election in just 2 years. So if the Democrats really want to advocate and push for Medicare for All, and I certainly hope they do, and certainly part of the Democratic Party has been pushing for that, I do think it's possible very soon. But, you know, it's not going to happen unless people push for it. If we go around saying things like days of big government are over, like Bill Clinton said, or it's just too expensive to have universal coverage, which people have said that as well, even though it's not true. We know Medicare for All is likely going to be cheaper than what we have now. It all depends on the political messaging that the Democrats are willing to do and the political mobilization that folks who advocate for Medicare for All, and I do advocate for Medicare for All, what we are successful in mobilizing.
With regard to the legislative piece of this, Democrats hold a razor-thin majority in the Senate, and as such, the principal hurdle, be it for Medicare for All or any of these other opportunities for progressive change, isn't simply pushing Joe Biden and his administration yet further to the left, but pushing Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and Lisa Murkowski, perhaps Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, other moderates further to the left on proposals that are cardinal to the progressive policy platform, even the $15 minimum wage, yet without bipartisan purchase. Too little discussion has centered on how to do this over the next 2 years while we still have the numbers we do now. In the report, you discuss three relevant principles: framing, coalition building, and direct action. Can you talk about what that might look like in practice to shepherd legislative change?
Let me just back up. I want to remind you, Trump tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act. He tried to repeal it and got close to doing it. The reason he couldn't repeal it is it was extremely unpopular to repeal the ACA at the time he was doing it. At the time, polls were showing only 17% of the American people supported the Republican alternative, which was basically just a form of repeal. So that's why things went the way they went. There was a lot of pressure on senators and congressmen from their constituents who actually did not want to see the ACA repealed at that point. And there was a giant movement. I mean, there were people in wheelchairs being dragged out of congressmen and senators' office in their wheelchairs supporting the ACA and opposing the repeal. I know Joe Manchin, that some of those people are not terribly liberal. They will move if the American people move and if there's a movement building for single payer. Having said that, you were asking about the framing, and I think we talked a little bit about framing, that telling people Medicare for All is a big government program is not going to be very popular. Telling them that it's a program that gets rid of the private health insurance industry, gives them complete free choice of doctor or hospital, and will cost the average American family less than what they're paying under the current system. That's pretty convincing messaging. And in fact, as you know, when Bernie Sanders started talking about it that way, his popularity skyrocketed and the popularity of Medicare for All actually skyrocketed. So some people have figured out really good ways to frame it. I know, you know, I'm a physician and I talk to physicians and can be very wonky and difficult to understand when I talk to non-physicians about single payer Medicare for All. So I have to listen to some other people on the framing. Certainly about strategy and tactics, figuring out who are our allies. And frankly, I think in Medicare for All, we have a lot of potential allies among health professionals. We've organized health professionals within Physicians for a National Health Program. The largest nurses union has been pushing for Medicare for All. In the past, social workers have endorsed it. I don't know that they've been very active lately, but I think if somebody worked with them, mobilized, they would be active again. So I think as a healthcare professional, part of my job is to work with healthcare professionals around the issue and think of what other constituencies there are. I think most Americans will be much better off with it. So that's thinking about constituencies and how you work with them. That would be strategy and tactics. I think coalition building, obviously, that's really important. And that's figuring out whose interests you share. And I've talked about disabled people in wheelchair. The disability rights movement has been very active, for instance, in health reform. I think it's really possible to connect with a lot of the Black Lives Matter movement. There's actually been a lot of support of Medicare for All within the Black community, particularly among the Congressional Black Caucus. I think all of those things are really important, and they're part of how we move forward to fix the situation here, fix what I call the conditions that have made Americans so unhealthy. And we haven't talked much about it, but I think a lot of this coalition has to do with reaching out to people of other races, other religions, other ways of thinking, and building those coalitions between these different groups.
Yeah. It seems that a lot of the recommendations that you are advancing as a commission require and entail political activism of the most basic kind. And at the same time, obviously, it's the Lancet Commission. It's published in a medical journal. These recommendations are tailored to and speaking to principally health professionals and the health professional workplace. How do you reconcile this need for, again, basic political activism with health professionals and especially physicians' longstanding reticence to civic engagement intrinsic to their profession and their training?
Well, I think before 2020, it might have been possible for a physician to believe that all you had to do was go to your office or the hospital and do a good job and things would get better. I think it was also easy to believe that you should be anti-racist because it's the right thing to do and fair, but that it didn't really have much effect on your life and your future. But I think we've seen with the COVID pandemic, if you have an incompetent administration that lacks compassion, that lacks any sense of fairness or equity or respect for science, it can kill you. It can kill tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of people. And then I think if you look at what happened January 6th, when people with Confederate flags stormed the Capitol, you need to understand that failure to deal with racism in this country may destroy American democracy. We're very, very close to allowing the racism that Trump mobilized to completely destroy our democracy and maybe with it the planet. I think people really have to understand that in order for our patients to survive, in order for our democracy to survive, we need more than you and me showing up at the office or the hospital to take good care of people. We really need to engage with getting rid of these bad public policies we've had for a generation and getting rid once and for all of the racism that was really foundational to this country, really confronting it and building bridges to get rid of racism in this country.
You're a professor of medicine. You're also a clinician. You're an advocate as well. Do you think that the gatekeepers of power within the broader health profession are increasingly amenable to that type of change? And do you see from a pedagogical perspective too that the training of health professionals is evolving to align with this growing need?
A lot of the change I've seen is from your generation, people your age, pushing your professors, pushing your deans. We have to do something about racism. We can't just stand by. We have to do something about social justice. That is our lane. That's part of what we need to be thinking about as doctors. Certainly, folks my generation are changing, but we've been pushed by people your generation to really rethink what we're doing. And similarly, hospital leadership tends to be very economically oriented. They see their job as making the institution thrive and function economically. But that's not the main raison d'etre of a hospital. The main raison d'etre of a hospital is to protect the health of its community. Again, the community needs to push the hospital leaders. So there's a role for everyone here to really rethink the way doctors have sort of stood back and said, all we need to do is the science and the biomedical stuff. We're not going to make it if that's all we do. We really, in order to keep our patients alive, our democracy alive, people need to start to engage in civic discourse and in politics.
I hope you keep singing that song. I could not agree with you more. And I've often felt like in Outlier, even especially in my residency, advocating a more direct role of physicians in the civic discourse and in political activism, which I think is imperative to improving the health of our especially most vulnerable patients, because so many of these policies wield an outsized effect, an even more powerful effect than anything we could fathom or perform within the bounds of the hospital walls. And so I think equipping the physician workforce, the broader health professional workforce, to engage and understand and advocate on behalf of these issues is one of the best things we can do to improve public health. But I want to get back to the commission a little bit. You were convened, of course, again in 2017 before any prediction for the 2020 election could be set. What role did you envision for this report if the post-2020 administration were not more sympathetic to your goals and your values? And did that possibility distort or otherwise imbue the design, the focus, the recommendations of the report?
Yeah. Dr. Horton asked me to co-chair the commission in 2017, and we started to gather data both about the policies and the effects of the policies. And there's a fair amount of numerical data in the report about the number of deaths from various Trump policies. We thought that the report would come out in about August of 2020, before the election and before we had any idea who was going to win or lose. We got bumped by COVID pandemic. You probably know that journals were getting about five times as many articles as usual because people were in such a rush to learn everything they could about COVID as fast as they could. We got bumped by the pandemic. At the time we were finishing up most of the writing, we weren't sure who was going to win, but we were betting, I guess, that it was going to be a new administration and that we would be working with them. Frankly, if Trump had been reelected, our recommendations would have been the same. We would have been much more pessimistic about actually getting them done, but our recommendations would have pretty much been the same. As a scientific journal, the job was really to talk about the expected outcomes from these bad policies Trump was implementing, to tabulate and see if it was in fact true that he was causing increased deaths, which of course it turned out to be true. And we were not necessarily originally charged with looking back at the 40 years of bad public policy that had failed to create the conditions for health. But as we delved into the data, we did see the United States had had this very dramatic lag in its life expectancy beginning about 1980. And then we ended up tracing a lot of these harmful policies back to the Reagan era, let's say, the beginning of the Reagan era. And then finally, some of the minority members on the commission were very vocal in like educating us about the role of really structural racism that grows out of, for instance, for Native Americans, they had their land stolen and you're not going to do very well if someone steals all your wealth and sometimes imposes genocide on your people. And similarly with African Americans began with the momentous crime of slavery and then another 100 years of Jim Crow legislation and continued discrimination, not just in policing, but in jobs and education and all aspects. A lot of other aspects affect health, housing discrimination. So we kind of started with the 4 years of Trump, which there's plenty to say about the harms he did to health, but then I guess an exponential backwards gaze at 40 years of failed policies, starting with Reagan, what we called neoliberal policies, and then 400 years of American racism, because our job was to say, what do we need to improve the health of the American people? And we need, first of all, to repeal or revoke essentially all of Trump's health policies. We need to move in a different direction from the generational 40 years of neoliberal policies. And then we have to once and for all really confront and deal with racism in this country.
You said you got bumped for the COVID pandemic, and that constituted an entire section of the report. The first section of the report discussed that pretty heavily. And you mentioned that 4 out of 10 deaths of the last year could have been averted had better political decisions been made. What specifically went wrong here in our conception of or treatment of public health? I know we need to have a policy grounded in evidence, grounded in science and compassion, but what would the particulars of that look like?
This is one of the interesting things of the report. We worked together with the editors of the American Journal of Public Health to talk about the weakening of public health. And most of that was written before COVID really hit. It was written actually before March of 2020. But what we discovered when we looked at what had gone on with public health is that there had been a gradual defunding of public health that caused about 20% of the public health workforce in county and state governments to be laid off. Turns out a lot of the public health funding actually comes through the CDC and is given out to county and state health departments as grants. So cuts in CDC funding had resulted in 20% fewer frontline workers in public health, which was 20% fewer people to do the work we needed when COVID hit. Trump in 2017, when he first came in, there was this government shutdown, which caused a hiring freeze at the CDC. 700 positions were left vacant because of the hiring freeze. He was very demoralizing to the entire scientific community. 1,600 government scientists left their positions during Trump. He was just not listening to them. Half of all key science policy leadership positions were left vacant throughout the Trump administration. So for most of the time, there was no administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration under Trump, the leading agency that's supposed to tell you how to stay safe at work. The Obama administration had been completing something called the Airborne Pathogen Standard. There's a bloodborne pathogen standard that we all know in healthcare about how you handle blood so that you don't transmit HIV or hepatitis. And the Obama administration had almost finished the airborne pathogen standard to prevent airborne transmission of infection or non-infectious illness. And it was ready to go, and the Trump administration just killed it in the spring of 2017. There were lots of signs, even before COVID hit, that it was weakening our public health capacity, that the next time there was a public health crisis, we were not going to be ready for it. And lo and behold, then the pandemic hit, and sorry to say, we were proved correct. We were not ready. That would have been bad enough. But then, of course, once the pandemic hit, Trump denied that it was going on. He called it a hoax. He said it was about to disappear. It was also very clear when it began to emerge that most of the victims were Hispanic people, were Black people, were Native American people. All of a sudden, he lost interest in it. And that stopped really doing any efforts, any serious efforts to mitigate spread, and just gave an open highway to the virus to spread throughout the American population. We did the comparison to the rest of the G7, and they did not do that well. Many of them did very, very poorly. But relative to the average level of performance, what we should have at least been able to achieve that average, our death rates were about 65.5% higher, meaning that 40%, 4 out of every 10 people who died from COVID in this country should be alive, could have been alive if we'd just done the average of other G7 nations. A lot of this is directly related to the idea Trump had that you don't need to listen to science, that anything public is bad, you have to privatize everything. Who needs public health? Let's just let the private sector do things. That really didn't work out very well with the pandemic, and it's not going to work out over the longer term in terms of maintaining the health of American people.
I really appreciate the point you make, too, about underinvestment in public health. I think America as a society has long been obsessed with biomedical interventions. We deify new drugs, new technology as panaceas against disease. Even the vaccine, we have the Operation warp speed, which was probably one of the silver linings of the Trump administration's handling of the pandemic. But at the same time, we could have deployed a whole army of tools, social interventions that would have rendered the vaccine less urgent and less critical than it is now, from a contact tracing workforce to a mask mandate to family leave and paid sick leave. And I guess it's just what strikes me is that like 200 years ago, medicine not only acknowledged but stood for these interventions. It recognized irrevocably that a disease only becomes a pandemic if you layer on food insecurity and income inequality and housing instability. It framed itself in the words of probably someone who's amused to both you and me, Rudolf Virchow, as essentially a social science. But in the last 50 years, we've lost that focus, fetishizing biomedical marvels over community health infrastructure that I think could have overwhelmingly stanched the tide of COVID-19 deaths last spring and last summer.
Yeah. I'm an internist, I think you are as well. And we love biomedical stuff. That's what we do all day, do a lot of work with drugs and biomedical stuff. But I agree with you completely that if you overemphasize that and don't pay any attention to the social side, you do end up in the situation the U.S. is in right now. We're spending more than $10,000 per capita on healthcare. We're spending 40% more than the rest of the developed world on a per capita basis. And yet we're living 3.4 years shorter. So that's what happens when you just pay attention to the biomedical and ignore public health. And you know, Canada, they have fancy machines and drugs as well. They have a lot of biomedical stuff, but they have the good sense to devote 6% of their healthcare budget to public health. Whereas in the United States, we used to devote 3.2%. We're down to about 2.5%. Spending $10,000 a person and devoting 2.5% to public health is really not working out very well for the American people. We'd live a lot longer if we got more balance in there.
I think some of the states during the last year recognized that. You discuss in the report, too, how the federal government is not the only lever of progress. You give a couple examples from the COVID-19 pandemic to the Paris Agreement when California and Washington and New York inaugurated the U.S. Climate Alliance to meet the same targets of the Paris Agreement when the Trump administration withdrew from it. What ways do you foresee the states over the next 4 years pushing forward the agenda of health and economic security, recognizing, of course, that many of them now suffer newfound financial constraints from the COVID-19 pandemic?
The states were extremely important when the federal government was ignoring health. So if the federal government's going to ignore pollution, it becomes very important that states pay attention. If he's going to ignore global warming, then the states have to pay attention. Over the long run, though, this has to be federal because particularly in a recession like we're in right now, the federal government has the ability to borrow money. They can borrow all they want, and states don't have that ability. I guess with the exception of Vermont, it's the only state that's allowed to run a deficit, and I'm not exactly sure why that even is. But the other 49 states have to balance their budget every year. When you're in a recession, you're going to have to turn to the federal government to fund the programs you need to get yourself out of the recession, in this case, the stimulus package, to fund what you need for public health, the vaccine distribution, the vaccine purchase, the funding for people who lack health insurance. I think the states are important, and they certainly were very important during the Trump era in trying to protect the people within their own state. But we do need the federal government here. I guess I'm from the South. I grew up in Louisiana, and it's all the more important for the people in Louisiana that federal government get involved, because it isn't clear to me, even though there are some good people in state government, by and large, the state government has not done much of a job in terms of protecting the health of Louisiana.
That's true. Well, Steffi, I know we're rapidly approaching the end of our time together, but I wanted to ask you, for those that are listening, are there certain books, original papers, other resources that you would recommend they consult if they wanted to better understand the context of this report and the policies that it recommends?
The report itself is 49 very dense pages, so that's going to take you some time to read the report. I do recommend it. We've got a wonderful group of authors or experts on nutrition, on immigration policy, on occupational environmental health, on racism, on population health, who wrote various chapters of this. I really do recommend that people read the report, and many of the, there's I think 350 references in there. So there's a very long list of things that people should be listening to and learning about. I would definitely recommend that if people want to delve deeper. I don't expect them to read every word of this 30,000 word report, but there's a lot of sections of it that I think would be very helpful for some of the listeners.
Well, thank you so much, Steffi, for joining us again today. I appreciate your taking the time, and all the best as you continue to disseminate the findings of the commission. I look forward to sharing the work and hope to see some of these policy predictions come true.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again to Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler for joining us, and thank you to all of you for listening in. For more information, check out the Commission's full report and its associated editorials and graphics. These are linked on our website, civic-rx.org, or in this episode's description, located wherever you get your podcasts. I am your host, Dr. Sejal Hathi. See you next time.